Welcome to the Classicist Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, and the classicist is Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ilya Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, you've been writing lately about how the COVID pandemic has exposed a lot of America's elites. I mean, this in theory should have been a moment for them to step up the kinds of epidemiological insights that are needed in a crisis like this, these ghastly trade-offs that have to be considered between the public health side of the equation and the economic side. These are the kinds of things where Americans like to console themselves in more normal times by thinking, well, if things ever go south, we've got these kind of experts on call. We have a break in case of emergency option. And your diagnosis in the writing that you've been doing on this recently, to paraphrase Adam Smith, is that there's a great deal of ruin in our elites. So walk us through what you've seen over the last couple of months that leads you to that conclusion.
Well, it was an empirical observation because, remember, we were told by no less than the director of the World Health Organization that the virus was not transmissible. And then when it was transmissible and we had a travel ban, he said that it had no medical utility efficacy and it was a sign of homophobia and racism. That's who Joe Biden parroted. And then we were told at the beginning that masks were of no value. Then they would take it away from healthcare workers. Then we were told they were of somewhat value. Then we were told they were of enormous value because the method of transmission had changed from the experts. It was the first, it was a surface, and then it was droplets in the air, and then it was aerosol, mist in the air that spread the virus. And we were told the virus was mutating and getting more lethal. The virus was mutating and getting less lethal. Antibodies gave you 100% of immunity. Antibodies gave you some or no immunity. Hydroxychloroquine was valuable. It was only valuable with AZT. Neither one were valuable. Both were dangerous. Both were, again, valuable. 2 million people are going to die in the United States, 300,000, 200,000, 130,000, 102,000, 60, 67, 72. Gavin Newsom says 25 million Californians were affected, a 2.5% lethality rate at the time he made that prognosis. We should have about 1 million dead in California now. We have about 2,300. And so I guess what I'm saying is that there's no penalty for being wrong despite the social and political and economic consequences of people who listen to these experts. And the sort of the locus classicus or the emblematic of this was Neil Ferguson, not our Hoover's Neil Ferguson, but Neil Ferguson of the Imperial College in Britain, who was wrong about mad cow disease, wrong about swine flu, wrong about avian flu, wrong about MERS and SARS before. But for some reason, the British government listened to him, and he said 500,000 British people would be dead and if they didn't do what he said. And they did what he said a little late, and they're nowhere near a tenth of that. And he didn't follow his own rules. He had his mistress and he were having cavorting in violation of his own recommendation. So whatever barometer we use about the elite, they haven't done very well. And it poses the question, Euripides asked it in the Bacchae, what is wisdom? And it's not very smart for an official to rely on experts such as Andrew Cuomo not to scrub the subways. I think a cleaning person could have told him that would have been wise. It's not very smart to send people that have active and cases that are infectious with COVID-19 into nursing homes. I think you or I or Scott could have said that. That didn't happen. A lot of the mistakes, in other words, we've made have been a lack of common sense and not listening to people who have experience or on the front lines. We should be listening to the emergency room doctors, the people in the COVID wards, the people who empirically see which drugs, which techniques, which protocols work and which don't. As I said in the article, at the genetic sequence will be, you know, it's known pretty well, and its mutations and its nature are known pretty well, and they'll probably find, they being the researchers and the experts, will find a vaccination or an antidote. But that does not mean that they know how to craft social policy. It doesn't mean that they know how to treat patients. And they think they do, and that's what's, they never say they're sorry, they never say they're wrong.
To that point you just made, there is a wonderful section of this recent piece that you wrote for National Review, in which you talk about, you know, this very theme, the importance of kind of specialized academic research being synthesized with lived experience and common sense. And in making this case, you talk about how often innovation can come from non-specialists, from people outside of the field where they're innovating. Can you walk us through that analysis?
Yeah, I was very surprised at the reaction to that, because when you write an article, you never know whether people like it or don't, or will they read it. But that particular article really surprised me. A lot of people wrote me about it with anecdotal stories of their own, how they were treated poorly by experts. My only argument was that science is not just facts, but it's an art, and it's an evolutionary process, and it requires empirical data, constant testing, input from people of all walks of life. And what usually happens is that real breakthroughs and knowledge come from a variety of sources. I gave three examples from the classical scholarship that nobody had believed there was a Troy or a Mycenae. They were thought they were fictive places, la-la lands of Homer's imagination, until Heinrich Schliemann found Troy and he found Mycenae. He did a lot of crazy things as the father of archaeology, but that contribution stays. And he was a German banker, business person, sort of a disreputable guy, but no classicist at the time had the imagination to make that connection. And then another great classicist, classics discovery was Linear B. That's the syllabic script that we found on clay tablets at Mycenae, Tiryns, and the major Mycenaean sites. And Ventris was a cryptologist during World War II and an architect, and he used those techniques that he had used while working for the British intelligence services during World War II to look at patterns and models and frequencies in this syllabic script, and he said it was Greek. And when he plugged Greek equivalents in, all of a sudden, it made sense. It would say the king at Mycenae has so many hundreds of thousands of bushels of wheat, and it was nonsense before. And people said, well, they can't be Greek, because we know what the Greek letters look like, alpha, beta, gamma, and we know that the city state, and we know what Greek pottery looks like, and this junk at Mycenae looks like Egypt, or, you know, it looks like the Near Eastern kingdoms, and the script doesn't look like Greek. And then he shocked people. He said, well, they were Greek speakers, and they were destroyed, and their language and culture was forgotten in the Dark Ages, and they lived on in the Iliad and the Odyssey and folk tales of exaggeration and romance. But when the Greek language reemerged as a written language, it borrowed a different script. And that was just absolutely revolutionary in 1952. Third example was Milman Perry, and all of our scholars, the 19th century philologists, had always told us as 20th century that Homer sat down, as most people would have thought, and wrote out the Iliad and the Odyssey, and that he wasn't a very good poet, because 30% of the epic poems, the Iliad and the Odyssey, are repetitive. You've always heard rosy finger dawn, rosy finger dawn. You know, Hector fell down and his armor clattered upon him. Swift-footed Achilles. So why can't he have an imagination? Perry went up to Yugoslavia into the Balkans with a revolver in hand, listened to bards in the 1920s, and lo and behold, they could compose monumental epic poems of 12,000 lines and longer over 2 or 3 days. Each time he recorded it, it was a little bit different, because they were using Homeric-like formulae, and they were repeating themselves. So in other words, when they wanted to get a new idea, they would just go on autopilot, plug in a memorized description of how to build a fire or how to saddle a horse, and then they would resume and keep going the way Homer did. So it really changed Homeric scholarship. Rather than making Homer an unimaginative literate scholar. It made him into a genius who was able to carry the entire poems in his head until they were finally written down sometime probably around 650 BC. But the point I was trying to make in that article was that real breakthroughs are a combination of scientific disciplines and eccentrics, oddballs, heterodox thinkers, people that we don't like. Schliemann had a tragic life. He was despised. He had an ear infection and died. Milman Perry dropped the revolver out of his suitcase and it went off, shot him in the heart and killed him at 33. Michael Ventris, at the height of his powers in his 40s, was killed in an auto accident. So yeah, they didn't end well, but they did a lot, and they were never given the encouragement or the honors that they deserved. And I tried to apply that to this situation, that we have a lot of very brave people who are trying to figure this thing out, and the Anthony Faucis and the Neil Fergusons of the world are not appreciative. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but Anthony Fauci said the other day there was no way that this Wuhan virus could have escaped from that Wuhan lab. He doesn't know that. We do know that he convinced the National Institute of Health to give the Wuhan virus lab $7 million so that they could work on, you know, enhancement of effect in viruses. And so I would say that most people who live in my agricultural community, if you said to them 5 years ago, do you really think you should give the Communist Party government in China $7 million and expertise so they can make a sophisticated lab to monkey around with viruses after what happened in SARS? They would say no. Only a person who is an expert could say, well, here's the reason why I did it. And it's a very narrow reason, and it has very narrow logic, and it's not applicable to the real world.
So all of this leads me to the question of how you build better experts. So, Victor, you've always been something of an outlier in that you've got the scholarly background and the PhD and a huge corpus of work behind you, but you also have this parallel set of experiences out in the Central Valley dealing with agriculture and the natural world, which combines to give you a very distinct perspective. And you and I have talked before about the increasingly narrow path on which academics and people in PhD programs are put, where they wind up hyper-specialized, often in marginalia, but without much insight on the wider world, and oftentimes without even much insight into some of the most important aspects of their own field. Is there a method that seems obvious to you by which we could improve this? Have we broken the way that we build scholars?
Yeah, we have. I think we would, first of all, have to shorten the PhD program to 4 years. I finished in 4 years. I could have finished in three, but I didn't want to lose my fourth year of scholarship. It's pretty easy to do. And we should make scholars teach beginning Latin, in my field, Greek or Spanish or French. They have to know how to teach a 1A class. And that means that they have to have definable teaching skills. And it used to be, when I was a student, if you were a good teacher, you were not a good scholar. That's what we were told. I remember when I won the American Philological Association Teaching Award, my thesis advisor called me up and said, oh my God, you've ruined your career. Nobody's going to take you seriously anymore. And the other thing is, the professional schools in every field have been politicized. So by that, in two ways, I mean the admissions now are not necessarily meritocratic. We want this many people of this background and this many people of that background, and we're going to get it, damn it, any way we can. And if that means that you can, say, enter a PhD program with 1 year of Latin and 1 year of Greek, who's to say you need Greek and Latin to be a classicist? That kind of logic. And then when we get in the professional schools, we get these dash studies courses. So instead of learning prosopography, numismatics, papyrology, manuscript tradition, you're getting gender studies, or you're getting race studies, or you're getting all of this other stuff that doesn't give you the basic skills to be a classicist. And I can remember as a professor, each year that I would interview people, because we had seven people I built in the department, when I would try to interview somebody, I couldn't rely on their philological skills. I thought, how am I going to turn this person loose to teach Latin 1A if somebody says, hey, what's you know, Latin or Greek 1A, what's the word for house? And they wouldn't know in Greek, so, or in Latin. And so what I would do is have them try to translate a little piece that I had done, and most of us had done as undergrad, and they couldn't do it. They could tell you everything about the cult of transgender worship of Dionysus Asiaticus in, you know, Ephesus, but nothing about how you, what the gerund is and why Greek doesn't have a gerund, or what the articular, none of that stuff. So that's what's happened. It's been politicized and it's been specialized at the same time. And then there is a sort of a prejudice against the deplorable, clinger, muscular classes. I know that when I did a dissertation, I was just struck that I just didn't believe that the Spartans destroyed all of the agricultural infrastructure of Athens in 30 days in 431. And I had said that because I used to pull out fruit trees all the time and vines. It's very hard to do. And even when you pull them out, they sprout back up. And I would, so for that dissertation, I would try to burn olive trees in Greece with some villagers, and I would try to do it back on my farm. It was very hard to do, much harder than vines. Destroy 2,000 vines per acre, and we know that from ancient advice about planting. And so it really helped me, as long as I was able to collate that practical knowledge with, you know, a knowledge of classical Greek authors, ability to read in the original languages, the understanding of epigraphic knowledge of inscriptions and coins, numismatics, and all that. And so I guess what I'm saying, it's a balance. And what I'm really resent about these experts is that they never say something like the following. I think that the virus will not peter out as the weather warms up, because in my lab, I have found this. But I'm going to defer to my colleagues that are at, you know, Boston General Hospital on the front lines, and you should ask them if, it, as it gets warmer, are they getting fewer or more cases? Or do, when they see people who get a lot of sunlight and tan and have high vitamin, what's the effect? But they never do that. Instead, they just get haughty. And again, I don't want to pick on Neil Ferguson, the British Imperial College statistician and epidemiologist, but my gosh, he has been so arrogant and so wrong and caused so much damage and has not paid a professional price, really, that it's really... And that's beyond the hypocrisy of advocating policies that he himself had no intention of following.
The final question that I'll put to you on this point about experts and the gap between their reach and their grasp, there is oftentimes a real romanticism around the greatest generation on this front. Not only what was accomplished in World War II, but the post-war success of things like the Marshall Plan, the economic development of America in the 50s. There's a sense that at least in that moment, you did have a contingent of experts who really could get things done, and that we've lost something in the interim. How sympathetic are you to that view? And if it's applicable, what do you think the change owes to?
Well, you're absolutely right. When I was a little boy, my mother and her sister, I don't know why they did, but my grandfather in this little farm I'm sitting on right now, sent him to Stanford. And they went to undergraduate and graduate, and my mom got a law degree. But what was weird was their professors, every once in a while, would be motoring around. This is, I'm talking about the 1950s, and they had my mom maybe 20 years earlier. And they would pull in the driveway, and they were the nicest people in the world. And they were photographers, and they were golfers, and they had gardens, and they were the most down-to-earth people in the world. They weren't just pie-in-the-sky, eccentric, you know, specialists. And what I'm getting at is somehow we created this Mandarin cult of the PhD, the JD, the MD, that they are smarter than the rest of us because they can never be found wrong because they always narrow their field. You know, it's sort of like saying instead of knowing the alphabet A to Z, they only know Z, but they don't just know Z. They know one leg of Z. No, they don't know one leg. They know one particle of the leg of the letter Z, and then they're the expert on that. And so it's kind of a catch-22. The more narrower they get, the more irrelevant they are, but the less anybody can challenge them because they know so little outside of their field that they know so lot within it, but they don't realize that they've kind of like an eraser erasing themselves away from relevance. And that's what's happened. And I just wish somebody would say to Fauci, "Doctor, don't give any more money to that lab. It's controlled by the Chinese Communist government. They have no record of transparency. Don't do that. Take all the money. Never do that again." Or somebody would say, "Dr. Fauci, you told us in late January and early February not to worry. So we're not holding you to that, but we do think that you need to be a little bit more humble about your assertions. Don't tell us when you've given money to the Wuhan lab that it's impossible that that virus came out of that lab accidentally. You don't know that." And yet, I'm Dr. Anthony Fauci, and then we go on his resume and da 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 da. And you know, I think it's we worry about what university we graduate from, what degree we have, what billet we occupy, what title we now enjoy, and then we talk down to people. And that was what the election of 2016 was about. People make fun of Donald Trump, but if you just take a deep breath and think for a minute, he has an animal cunning that these experts don't have. He said a long time ago that he thought the warm weather would help us. They all laughed at him. They said there's no scientific proof. He said what do you have to lose with hydroxychloroquine? The people, contrary to the experts that are on the front line, say it has some efficacy. And he was the person that said, you know, "I think it's going to be like a bad flu." Well, a bad flu could be 1958 or 1967, 68, with somewhere around 120,000 deaths. I think we could get up to that by the end of next fall. So he just did that on, I guess, practical knowledge, common sense, and everybody, you know, trashed him. But what he was getting at is that what's going to guide us are, at these press conferences, a Joint Chief of Staff person for 3 minutes saying, "This is what I'm worried about. The USS Roosevelt has infection. China's doing this. Iran's doing this. These people are taking advantage." And then we go to the economic expert. He says, "I'm worried because it's going to take this many months to get back to full unemployment." And then we go to the epidemiologist and get, you know, a take on the medical, but we haven't had that. We've taken Dr. Fauci and turned him into Zeus, and as if he knows how to, you know, take an economy of 330 million people and shut it down. So he says, "Well, you know, we just can't. I just don't like what I say." And then anybody within 5 seconds can go onto the internet and see all sorts of scientific studies that'll say the virus is not transmitted outside. 3% of all transmissions take place outside. Vitamin D levels are very important. The virus over 85 degrees dies very quickly. And then you're wondering, why are we staying inside and having older people sheltered and then young people go in and out? We don't, and we're destroying the economy to do that. We might as well do that with the economy open and let, if we're going to do that anyway, let people get out. They're not going to transmit it out in the open air very much. They know how to conduct themselves inside, and maybe they don't need 70% herd immunity. Maybe they need 10 or 20 because they don't seem to be very vulnerable, most of the population, to infection. And you know, maybe 20% of the population is infected, and maybe this is like the flu and it'll die out, or maybe it's like the other coronaviruses, common colds, or SARS-1 that died out. But when you start to say that, these people say, "Well, according to my gene sequencing, that's just impossible." And I say that as somebody who was the victim of a hit piece in Slate magazine where this writer said, "This is impossible that you could have had any case before the first of the year, our gene sequencing." She didn't know that. And now we're learning that patient zero in China has been backdated from late January to mid-November, and people are suggesting people in California were dying in January who were infected by people inside California at the first of the year, and now doctors are scrambling to look at autopsies and lab reports because they think there were cases in November or even October. The Italians think even September, given the perfidy of the Chinese. So, again, tyranny of specialized knowledge without audit or the check of common sense and practical experience in the real world has really hurt us in this crisis.
You've been listening to the Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read all of Victor's work at victorhanson.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at VDHanson. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.